Week 6, description and division of the divine attributes. I know we already went into the unity of God, but the whole purpose of doing that attribute first, kind of subjective, you know, where you start with, but I did have a reason for it methodologically, and it was just to establish that theology as a subject matter and theology as the foundation of everything else in our thinking has to be unified, so that that unity and diversity that's so important to philosophy and our whole worldview is maintained in our theology. But having established that, it is logically coherent, because then I turn to the argument in defense of divine unity, it's logically coherent to say that God's existence and essence are identical, ontologically. You might remember that chart I did last week. Here's God, circle, just representing God, not violating the second commandment, I'm just saying that represents God, and so in God, existence and essence are identical, ontologically. The first being as being. In other words, but that's not even the whole of metaphysics. And so, secondarily, propositionally, remember I put that box down here. And so I put in that box, quotation marks, divine attribute 1, divine attribute 2. Propositionally, it is intelligible, it is coherent to treat them diversely. You can distinguish the divine attributes as God reveals himself to be. The wrong idea you can get from that. Here's what I'm not saying. I'm not saying that, therefore, the diversity of the attributes is only subjective to us. That's not what I'm saying. They're also objective. But there's a first order and second order division of metaphysics. Ontology refers to being as being. And the rest of metaphysics refers to essence. And yes, we are treating existence as an essence and a predicate. We are ignoring Immanuel Kant. We are saying he's wrong about that. And therefore, we can make this division. If you accept Kant's criticism that existence isn't a predicate, then you can start to divide up the world this way, it's got to be one or the other. If you talk about God's existence and essence as a unity metaphysically, therefore you're saying that the diversity is only an illusion or a names we give, blah, 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 blah. I reject Kant's critique and happily say with all the medieval theologians, both. And anyway, sorry, I don't want to ramble on and repeat everything I said last week. I'm just saying that's where we ended last week. Having established that, we're ready to move on to the attributes as a whole. In most recent systematic theology textbooks, the most popular division of divine attributes is either called communicable and incommunicable, and sometimes Feinberg's book is one example, moral versus non-moral attributes. I prefer to talk about the communicable and incommunicable. Just as one example, Wayne Grudem's systematic theology breaks things down that way. And it'll be easy enough to tell the differences between the moral and the non-moral attributes. The basic difference between communicable and incommunicable attribute is not one that is able to be communicated intellectually for our consideration and the others not. That's not what... So let me draw this on the board. Should I make the mistake of putting incommunicable up there? Yeah, I will. This is limited, of course. This is an analogical description here. Incommunicable and communicable. I don't want to draw a line. Don't want to do that because I don't want to suggest in any sense that I'm embracing Kant's divide. So I'll put one over the other, communicable underneath it, but I will leave it open. The difference between them is not that one can be talked about and considered and the other can't. That's not the idea. Rather, a communicable attribute is one that is communicated or shared by God to man in the act of creating man. So we're not talking about speech here primarily. We're talking about the attributes communication, the sharing of the attribute, the reflecting, the manifestation of the attribute in the divine image. It's an attribute shared between God in his essence and his image in man. By contrast, an incommunicable attribute is one that God does not share with man. It is by definition non-man. But here's the problem. That breakdown is somewhat inexact because there's a lot of overlap. As Grudem remarks in his systematic theology, quote, There is no attribute of God that is completely communicable, and there is no attribute of God that is completely incommunicable. So that's important. For instance, some of the incommunicable attributes are at least shared with creatures in some respect, and none of the communicable attributes are shared with the creature in the same way as they exist in God. Think, for example, of Isaiah 55, where he says, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts," which implies both, that you have thoughts just like God has thoughts, and that your thoughts are not the same kind of a thing as God's thoughts. So there's unity and diversity there. If God is a unity, can we speak of his spirituality as amoral, or his love as divisible? So you see there's even overlap between the attributes and what kind of a thing they are. Among the communicable attributes, we will examine God's goodness, righteousness, love, power, and knowledge. Among the incommunicable attributes, we'll examine things such as God's aseity, his self-sufficiency, his infinity, his immutability, and immensity. And one of the things you're going to see right away is that those incommunicable attributes have a lot of ins and ims and ahs to them because they're not something. But we'll get to that. So right, that's what we're going to do. First session, we're going to talk about the incommunicable attributes. Second session, communicable attributes. Why are we doing this? This is more theology and less philosophical theology. Well, I think it's worth it to take 1 week to talk about what these, to just define them simply. Because if we're going to start mixing and matching them and setting them up and putting them in the lens of the philosopher and put them on the lab table and all those different things, we really ought to know what these things are. We really ought to put some labels and names and flesh. But that, yes, flesh, because Jesus is the Word made flesh. And the Bible says he's where we see God most clearly. Here's the big idea. God is both incomprehensible and the only ultimate object of our comprehension. You see that in Psalm 139, that tension. David says on the one hand, such thoughts are too high for me. I cannot attain them. The sum of your thoughts, and yet he spends the whole psalm staring in wonder at the sum of God's thoughts and ways. You see that tension everywhere, that God is both incomprehensible and the only ultimate object of our comprehension. We've already answered the agnostic to show why that can be the case. Why incomprehensibility does not mean can't talk about it, because everything else would break down if that were the case. Following from the unity of the divine essence that we talked about last week, we distinguish an essential attribute of God from two things that we're not going to talk about in this week. I got to unpinkify myself here. Forget it. I'm not doing pink, because you're not going to see it. Here's two things we don't mean by these essential attributes. Two other things that are worth talking about, but they're not what we're going to talk about here. Accidental predicates of God, namely, and there's two ways you can say it. One is God's covenant with Abraham. That belongs to the godness of God, accidentally. His essence eternally did not depend on him doing that. Otherwise, God would not be God. But you can even talk about it in ways that look an awful lot like divine attributes, namely, creator, sovereign ruler, providential ruler. These are attributes of God. They are attributes of God, but they're relational attributes of God in relation to things outside of himself. So we're not going to talk about that just yet either. Second thing we're not going to mean by this are intertrinitarian distinctions. In other words, relational distinctions within the Godhead. And one reason we're not going to talk about that and yet not be insecure about it is because this has to come first. If we want to maintain as Christians later on that the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit are all divine, I'd like to think that our first premise would be, what does divine mean? In other words, let's establish what God means, and then when the second premise comes around and we say that the Father is God and the Son is God and the Spirit is God, that will have a good idea of what we mean by God, and therefore they will share in this divine essence equally. So let's talk about this, the incommunicable attributes of God. Good way to avoid overlap and the incommunicable-communicable breakdown is to make a further division between those incommunicable attributes known best by negation and those known best by projection. Let me tell you what I mean by that. Those known principally by negation, in other words, by what God is not, will all begin with the in, I-N, or im, I-M, or ah, prefix. And that signifies a not nature, not this, not that. Then there's those attributes in which the image of God shares with the essence of God. These all begin with the omni prefix, because they are all the infinitely superlative degree of things that we can have as human beings. For example, omnipresence, here-ness or presence. We have here-ness or presence, but we don't have omnipresence. Then there's omnibenevolence. We have goodness, God has goodness, but we don't have omnibenevolence. Omnipotence, all power. We have power, we can move things, but we don't have all power. Omniscience, scientia means knowledge. We have knowledge, God has knowledge, but our knowledge isn't like his knowledge. We don't have omniscientia. But that would be redundant to include these in the incommunicable attributes, so we're going to reserve those for the communicable attributes and just see some overlap. So, we're only going to talk here about all of these ins, ims, and ahs, the incommunicable attributes that we know by negation. So in this category, I'll list them. We're going to see that God is, let's see, let's erase this thing from last week and just list them. God is independent or not dependent or self-sufficient. God is immutable or not mutable, not changeable. God is impassible, which a lot of people misunderstand today. Passio just means suffer. In other words, suffer action from without. God is uncaused. That's really all that means. God is infinite, or not finite, not limited. Also misunderstood. God is atemporal, not temporal, or in other words, eternal, timeless in his essence. And then finally, that last one we already talked about, God is incomprehensible. Not able to be exhaustively known, grasped in the sense of grasped hold of. Not that he cannot make himself known. That's another thing altogether. Where do I understand? Right here. All right, well, let's look at these in turn. The independence of God. That's called the first attribute which Scripture insists about God by Herman Bavinck in his Doctrine of God. He lists that first, and he's intentional about it. Because independence here means the same thing as self-sufficiency. Or what the old thinkers called aseity, from the Latin for of, a, and se, self. So, aseity, of himself, which doesn't mean he's his own cause. It's better to simply say self-sufficient or independent. And so we're going to picture, again, every time I do this circle, I'm just representing God to show you what each of these means. If God is independent, then I'm going to blank out everything else. Here's the problem with doing that immediately. There ain't anything else. Aside from God, from all eternity, God is God, and nothing else is, which is the strongest kind of independence that you can have. Every other kind of independence is a relative independence. I'm not dependent on that relative to all the other conditions and so on. But the strongest form of independence would be that if your being coexists with nothing. Because then it would be impossible. See, when we became independent from Britain, we actually had to put some effort into it. But God's independence is a logical necessity of his being. To be perfectly independent would mean that no power exerts itself upon the primal movements of the divine essence. No good thing is lacking, and therefore none is desired because of want or need. There is therefore a direct connection between God's aseity and God's happiness. Something we're going to do as we go through these attributes is start connecting them to other attributes as logical consequences, not as causal relationships. God's independence does not cause God's happiness in a sense of temporal succession, as if he wasn't happy until he figured out he was independent. Whoa, there's nothing else here. That puts a smile on my face. Not that kind of a thing. But so logical connection. We draw the inference, we figure it out, we discover that if God is independent, he must be the happiest being imaginable. Because there's nothing else that he could want. Because there's nothing else. Period. The perfectly independent being must be the most perfectly satisfied being conceivable. So, and the least frustrated being conceivable. So in other words, it's not enough to say that God is the happiest and least frustrated being in reality, which is true. Or that God is the happiest and least frustrated being in the whole universe, which is also true. But that it is not even possible to conceive of a greater happiness or a lesser degree of frustration in any being. It is logically impossible, it is analytically false, that there could be a higher happiness than God's independence. The reason is that if this being could conceive of something which does not presently satisfy him, then it must follow that something outside of him exists, that commands his preferences. A being in need, to any least degree, is a being in dependence, not independent. A being in need is a being that is dependent. Therefore, the supreme being must be logically, utterly independent. You see what's going on here? Natural theology is still operative. I see that it must be so, logically. The supreme being must logically be independent, or else he's not the supreme being by definition. God is also independent of supposedly abstract values that he must conform to. He himself is these things, as follows from what we talked about last week, divine unity. Remember that God is ontologically one, such that his subsistence is all of his attributes, without in any way making these attributes not themselves diversely intelligible. In other words, from divine unity, we deduce divine independence. All that is in God is independent from all that is not in God. Therefore, that God is omniscience, for example, depends upon omniscience, not causally, but logically. This is what planning I couldn't understand. There's not another omniscience aside from divine omniscience, for omniscience is in an omniscient mind. Omniscience is not an adjective which includes the omniscient mind and another body, for instance, or another instance of omniscience outside of the divine mind. It's not a class of omnisciences. There is only one omniscience, and that is an omniscient mind, because there's only one God. God is also immutable or unchanging. That's that second one. He is utterly other than the realm of becoming, making his own realm, that of being, revealing himself to Israel in Exodus 3:14 as I am that I am, and some Hebrew scholars think that it actually should even read, I will be who I will be, linking together ultimate personhood and ultimate being. He is the one who alone is sufficiently his own being. This includes not only the divine essence, but also God's knowledge and God's counsel and his decrees. All of those must be unchanging if he is the first cause. And his decrees and counsel are what create things outside of himself. Therefore, those have to be unchanging. Now, applying what we've already seen in the unity of God, we can see that if God is a unity, and if God is unchangeable, then all of God's attributes are unchanging. Let me draw that as a syllogism. Let's do it inside the circle. Premise one, if God is a unity, and if God is immutable, then by resistless logic, all of the divine attributes are immutable. You see how that follows? And I will go a step further and go out on the limb here and say that they have to be immutably immutable. Because, of course, if you can change the changelessness of a changeless thing, well, then it's not unchanging. So the love of God never changes. But then neither does His justice. And so neither does His wrath. This follows from the fact that divine goodness never changes, so that God cannot call good evil or evil good, such that as a good judge, He remains a just judge and must prosecute the unjust with an unchanging sentence all the way to the ends of the earth. If God intends to do something, it is because of an unchanging disposition of His moral character. And if that intention carries forward, then the intent would likewise seem to be unchanging. So the psalmist says in Psalm 33:11, "The counsel of the Lord stands forever, the plans of His heart to all generations." And the author of Hebrews says in chapter 6:17 about this salvation decree that it is unchanging or immutable in its character. If God is unchanging and God is the first cause, then the first cause of everything is unchanging. It's not that God's essence and God's ways happen to be unchanging, but that just like His independence, it is logically necessary and impossible for it to be otherwise. He is unchangeable. He is immutable, not able to undergo change. The word mutable comes from the Latin for to undergo change in composition, mutabilis, from which we derive another English word, mutation. God is not the sort of thing that ever could change, because change is a function of composition and affectation. In other words, something acting upon composition. In other words, you'd have to be in effect, by definition, to be changeable. A power sufficient to act upon another thing as a cause to an effect alone is what is responsible for change, and therefore only an inferior changes, according to the principle of sufficient reason. Remember that fourth law of logic. A cause cannot render to an effect that which it does not have to produce. And so, only an effect can undergo change. If the immutability of God implied that His thought is fundamentally non-original, in other words, one idea here is that, well, if God doesn't change, then He can't think about one thing versus another or act in relation to that thing as opposed to that thing and so on and so forth. Well, let's tackle some of these things. If the immutability of God implied that His thought is fundamentally non-original as opposed to ours, then His omniscience of all that He would do would necessarily imply that all created things are really an aspect of His unchanging unity. We're going to tackle that in detail in its own week. In other words, if God's immutable, and therefore His knowledge is immutable, then everything He knew He would do was necessarily the case, and not just so, but in His essence. And therefore, the created things are part of His essence. It's pantheism. And we're going to show you why that's not the case. Immutability does not mean, it doesn't mean you can't make that distinction between His knowledge in terms of the objects of His knowledge versus His knowing. We would call it a faculty. Well, that's even a problem. We'll get to that. Whole week on that. Don't lose it over that. Likewise, many suspect that divine immutability is opposed to divine action or relationship with the creature. But this fails to account for the difference between primal motion, ultimate cause, and local motion, proximate cause. I'm going to put that on the board. So that's the syllogism that shows you why it must be so. But let's then take that circle of immutability and apply it to the mutable. So, what were the two things under examination here? Action or relation. Let's put action directly under the circle. Because, again, the idea would be that He can't act, and we'll sort of make it go out that way. And then put relationship under. Relationship. Relationship to. So action upon and relationship to. And I'm going to put a bunch of X's on the very bottom line, going from left to right to show changeable things or particular things in motion. Okay? So the idea here is that if He is an immutable being, then He cannot relate to or act upon. But that fails to account for the difference between primal motion, which is ultimate cause, and local motion, proximate cause. And then in turn, the difference between motion from or out of God, so I'll draw arrows going this way down to these changeable things, and motion in God. Immutability refers to an absence of motion or change in God's essence. It does not refer to the relationship between God and the created order. Again, that is an accidental, in the old classical sense, property of God. God's relationship to Abraham is an accidental property of God. It is not part of his essence. And immutability refers to his essence, ontologically, not to his relationship to something outside of himself. So two simple distinctions here lead to these kind of confusions. There's all sorts of things in created order, in just things that you see on a pool table or in a chemistry under a microscope or whatever else, all sorts of things in which a larger, denser object moves upon a smaller, diffuser object. And I'm doing this just as a picture. I'm not saying that God is like the cue ball or he's like the bigger atom hitting into that. I'm not saying that. But my point is we see a picture of this already in nature, so we should be able to think about it. The cause, the bigger, denser thing, doesn't for that reason, its relationship to the effect, cease to be larger or denser than the object which it affects. Otherwise, we wouldn't be afraid of meteors coming too close to Earth. Okay? So, in fact, just the opposite is the case. The more unchanging an object is, the more power it may exert upon objects which are changeable. That's common sense when we think about it. But we just don't like to apply those things to God. We only like to apply pictures and creaturely things to God when we can strip God and knock him down. We typically don't like to look at pictures in the creation when we are reminded, oh yeah, everything else works like that too. Never mind. Scratch that. So immutability is not at all the same thing as immobility. It refers to God's essence, not to his relationship to things outside of his essence. God's immutability also refers to his eternity. That God is eternal sometimes belongs to the issue of atemporality. Again, we're going to do a whole week on that. And at other times, his immutability belongs to the issue of... what did I do? I put it both ways. Oh, God's eternal. Sorry. Here I'm talking about eternity. I got myself mixed up here. I'll put eternity inside the circle. And the reason I'm putting it inside the circle is because sometimes we use the word eternity and eternal loosely to talk about the eternal state. So, for example, the reward of eternal life or the experience of a believer in heaven or, for that matter, an unbeliever in hell. That kind of eternity subsists within this eternity. So, similar to holiness, in a sense. But immutability also refers to God's eternity. If I say God is eternal, sometimes I'm talking about the fact that he's timeless. Other times when I say God is eternal, I'm talking about this issue of immutability. In this sense, God always was and always will be. His eternity isn't a place in which he resides, it's something that he is. All else that is eternal resides in his presence. Now, it's fashionable enough in our day to imagine that the Bible never teaches God's transcendent existence in this way, but that is not true. I'll just give you one verse. Psalm 92, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. There's other verses that say it. I, the Lord, do not change. Father of lights, with him there's no variation or shifting shadow due to change. James 1:17, Malachi 3:6. But I give that one just because it gives a synonym of the same thing. Everlasting. From everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You say, well, wait a minute. That, even the poetic imagery there, if you want to take it seriously, only refers to a horizontal thing. But, of course, that doesn't even mean that the universe is not coexistent with him. And you're right, that verse doesn't. However, there's another verse that uses the same imagery and specifically couples it with the universe fading away like a garment. And that's Psalm 102:25. Okay, so the Bible does teach that God is above everything, including time. Impassibility. This one is hideously misunderstood by our non-philosophical age. Impassibility, one of the most misunderstood ideas in modern theology. It comes from the word to suffer, passio in the Latin, in the sense of being moved from beyond one's own being, which is already impossible for the first being. To the degree that one is an effect, to that degree it can suffer passion, or he can suffer passion. In other words, they did not use the word passion in this sense to mean emotion, affection, much less preference. Feeling for something. It's not the way they use the word passion. Now, it is true that the same Greeks that did use this word consigned the passions to the lower appetitive section of the soul and blah, blah, blah. So they devalued it. No question about that. But don't confuse those Greek philosophers with the whole of Christian theologians in the early era. That's a mistake. It's a guilt by association thing that tends to happen. Now, this most suspect doctrine of classical theism meant that when God moves, even where he factors in the movements of created beings, things like prayer, these secondary causes do not function as the efficient cause of his motion. They function as the formal cause of his motion. So, for example, in Revelation 8, we see the picture of the prayers of the saints rising to the throne of heaven, and an angel filling up this as incense in this golden bowl that it gives to God, and God is pleased with it, gives it back to the angel. The angel throws it back on the earth in peals of lightning and thunder. Translation, the prayers of the saints in Eastern Europe and across the world brought down the Iron Curtain. Prayer works. But not because God needs an advisor, nor because he wasn't doing that. He uses the prayers of the saints. In fact, C.S. Lewis, even in an article, in an essay on prayer, quotes Pascal. Pascal made the point that God lends to us prayer to lend to us the dignity of causality. Of course, back then, prior to the 1950s, people understood there were five different kinds of causes. After the 1950s, people typically don't understand that. They say, well, how can this cause this and this cause this at the same time and the same... Oy. There's a difference between efficient cause and formal cause. God uses things like prayer and evangelism as a formal and material cause to change things in this world. But they are not the efficient cause of his motion. Naturally, in our flight from the classical Western thought form, the notion of impassibility is recast as the belief that God is unmoved in the sense of being a cold and aloof theoretical construct, above and beyond the cares of man, and therefore not caring for us. And very unhelpfully, the critic can easily locate Greek thinkers who did conceive of the divine essence in exactly this way. The straw man is then burned in effigy and then locked on top of the books of all the medieval theologians with no questions asked. But that is a profound mistake. Impassibility simply means that God is the first cause. That's all it means. That's all it means. God is infinite. Infinite. That means not finite. No limitation. Again, another one badly misunderstood. No limitation of genuine being imposed on him. You might think of that when we conceive of limitation. For example, God cannot lie, or God will not delay forever, or God is not Bill, for example. You might get the idea, when you think about this kind of limitations, that these negations suggest definition. And of course, definition is what happens when we define something, when we limit something. In other words, by definition only applies to the finite. So that if God has any contours, then he's not infinite. That's the idea. Very confusing idea. The very definition of definition is that the thing we define is finite. It's not everything else, it's this thing. The thing is what it is and something else, not something else. So the law of identity would seem to demand that nothing could possibly be infinite. But this is a confusion of concepts. We know infinity by what it is not. It is not limited. In other words, there's no being separate called infinity in the class of finite things. It's a definition of, or by negation. We have to also remember that God is not only infinite, he's also all of his other attributes. So, for example, there's no limit to his power, no limit to his love, no limit to his immutability. So that it's not a being called infinity that's not limited, but a being who is all of his attributes unlimited. Do you see the difference? In other words, we're not saying that limitlessness is a being with parts in a set. We're saying that the attributes of God are limitless. It is an aspect of His being. Of course, if infinity stood on its own, then the indefinable nature of infinity would indeed negate its lone attribute, for its whole essence would resist definition. But God is not merely infinite. He is God unlimited. Okay, that's what we mean by infinity. We don't mean a separate God apart from God called infinity, which then is resisting definition because that's the lone predicate, so that if you define it, you'd wipe it out of existence. These are the attributes of God, unlimited. And so there's a sense in which infinity is a positive attribute of God, in the sense in which He is illimitable. Let me put that up there. And again, this follows by resistless logic from Him being the first cause. What would you need as a necessary condition to limit something? Go easy. Don't think of like hard things. What's the basic thing you need to limit something else? Something else. Right? What limits things? But other things. Friction. Death. Stuff. But if you're the first cause, and nothing exists besides you, then by definition, you must be infinite. Because all that we mean by infinity is limitless. The coexistence with nothing else-ness of God. He does not just so happen to be infinite. His essence is not the sort of thing which could be limited. For that which limits is prior. But nothing is prior to the first cause, as we've already demonstrated. So by resistless logic, God must be, following so far, He must be independent. He must be immutable, He must be impassible, and He must be infinite. That follows from the other proofs of natural theology. If they're true, then by resistless logic, these are invincibly true. God must be these things or nothing else would exist. Now the value, practically, of thinking about divine infinity is the sense in which it helps our idea of God comprehend more of what we ought and restrict from us more of what is none of our business. If it is good and perfect, God has it to the uttermost. If we cannot think of it, we shouldn't pretend that we have thought of it. It should also be clear that infinity is not self-referential, since it expresses a negation of the opposite of illimitability. In other words, it's referring to other things, but since other things do not exist, then it must be. Therefore, it does not refer to things indiscriminately. This is another practical application, and this is what I really meant when I said infinity is misunderstood. Here's some practical, popular misunderstandings of infinity as applied to God. Infinity, or infinite, does not refer simply to all, but all in a specified class. In other words, if I say that something is infinite, I'm saying that something is infinite. I'm not saying that everything is infinite because of its infinity. I'm referring to it at that point. Okay? So the infinite does not refer to all indiscriminately, but to a specified class. To be infinitely durable is not to be a squirrel. It's not the same thing. If I love infinitely, it does not follow that I must love an object which is inherently unlovely. For love, if it exists infinitely, by definition, is going to refer to love, to what is lovely in its perfection, and not to objects which may or may not exist. If love is an eternal attribute and God alone is eternal, well then divine love does not refer to anything outside of itself, but refers only to itself. So to suppose some one-to-one correspondence between infinity and the object which may or may not be related to a member of its class is to suppose that the infinite degree of everything is a predicate of the class of everything, which is nonsense. In that case, if something would be infinite, then everything would refer to that thing and be that thing. And then you'd have monism, you'd have pantheism. But then it would be kind of meaningless to call that thing infinite, because then nothing else would be. So infinity, by definition, applied to a thing, refers to itself. This safeguards us against both the pantheism, which was gaining steam among mystics and rationalists alike in the Enlightenment, and the common demand on God's infinitely loving to love indiscriminately in today's evangelicalism. From God's infinity of being, we deduce his omnipresence. If God is infinite, he must be omnipresent. From his infinity of consciousness, we deduce his atemporality, or eternity over against time. So, let me draw those two lines. Remember the unity of God. He hasn't become ununified from step one to step five. If God is infinite, and his entire unity is infinite, then it must follow by resistless logic that he is omnipresent, since his spirit is infinite, limitless, and that he is omniscient, since both his mind and his spirituality, which we'll talk about those, are infinite spirit and infinite knowledge. His eternity over against time is infinite and present. Time is the finite perspective of the consciousness moving through space. It is finite consciousness plus finite space. And we will do a whole week on that, because that is a mysterious concept, but it's where one of the major battlegrounds is. That's why I'm doing a whole week on it, so don't try to get all that in your head right away. But at any rate, by divine atemporality, which is that second to last one that we're getting to, we're making a straight line. We're not just listing them. We're saying that if one is true, this has to be true. If that's true, this has to be true, and so on and so on and so on. They are, in a sense, analytically contained within each other. But divine atemporality, here's what we mean. We mean that God is not limited to or constrained within the confines of time. He is related to time in the same way he's related to finite consciousness and finite space. If he is an infinite consciousness and infinitely pervading through space and not limited by space, then he's going to be related to these two things in the same way. He is the creator and sustainer of both. He knows it in its every detail, infinitely more than if he experienced it as a finite subjective point. What the objections are going to say is that if he doesn't experience it, and they won't use the word experience, it's called the fallacy of equivocation, it's a card trick. They will say, if he doesn't know it's 601, what did he do? Know it's 601. What does that mean? You mean experience it as a finite reference point. That's the idea. Well, a rock is in time, and a man is in time. A rock even lasts longer in time than a man. But does a rock, for that reason, know time more than or just as much as the man? Of course not. Objective knowledge, therefore, does not depend upon subjective reference points. And a subjective reference point is just a consciousness at a fixed point. But objective knowledge is consciousness plus identity. Mind plus being right about what you're talking about. And that's what God has that we don't. We've already indicated that the incomprehensibility of God, that's that last one, so I'm not going to get too much into it, but we've already basically commented that it refers to the inability of our reason to grasp hold of him or to know him exhaustively. Since God is infinite, it follows that no matter how much we learn about him, we'll always only ever scratch the surface of the divine essence. What it does not mean is that God is unable to make himself known to us. God has revealed himself to us, partially, but sufficiently, which is why we can speak truly about anything at all. And again, I would refer you to our talk on agnosticism to remind you why God is incomprehensible means that we can't know anything about him, why that proposition is incoherent logically. So any questions about the incommunicable attributes of God and why they are logically necessary?